PFK is easy. Call 1-818-985-5735, press 2, or donate online anytime at kpfk.org/donate. Even consider becoming a sustainer with monthly recurring donations. Much love to KPFK and everyone who supports it.
Hello, this is Ben Taylor, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
En una noche de luna.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. Apologies for the way I sound this week. I'm just recovering from a cold. Well, this week we'll go to Minneapolis to get an eyewitness report from scenes of ICE terror. My guest, Maria Burns-Ortiz, is a former journalist living in Minneapolis. She's been documenting ICE's savagery and will share her observations with us. Then, staying in Minneapolis, professor and author Shannon Gibney will join me to discuss how Minnesotans are done playing nice with ICE and how lessons from the George Floyd protests are being deployed effectively against ICE. Finally, Liz Perlman, executive director of AFSCME 3299, will explain how activists are pushing state governments to counter Trump's tax cuts for the rich with higher state taxes. We'll discuss how Governor Gavin Newsom of California is showing his true colors by opposing a statewide billionaire tax. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. In the weeks since the January 7th ICE killing of Renee Good, a Minneapolis mother and wife, protests have continued to escalate in response to the violence of federal agents. Reports of horrific savagery at the hands of ICE agents against immigrants and citizens, women and men, and even babies, are emerging. Right-wing agitators such as Jake Lang have descended on Minneapolis, and among those who have been witnessing and documenting the chaos on the streets of the Twin Cities is my guest, Maria Burns-Ortiz. A nonprofit executive director, game studio founder, and former journalist, she lives in Minneapolis with her husband and three children. Welcome to the program, Maria.
Thank you.
So first, tell me what is it that you have witnessed? You know, what we're seeing here in Southern California, where I'm based, are just news reports. But we're seeing people like yourself documenting the abuses, posting it to social media, and it looks terrifying to just even walk on the streets of Minneapolis these days. Give us a sense of what it's like right now.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a very scary time here for a lot of people. Normally it's Minnesota in the winter. It's you know, where it's cold, it's all of these things, but it is really, I keep telling people, and I think people kind of don't understand what you're seeing. It's actually worse. It is, there is fear within, especially the immigrant community here, that people are terrified. You know, they are staying in their houses, they are going into hiding. This is not an exaggeration. You know, people are being grabbed off the streets. They're being taken when they're dropping their children at the school bus. There's multiple cases of this has been reported. American citizens are being ripped out of their cars, as my husband and I and a number of other citizens saw last week, just off of the streets. And so I think that is, it's really, like I said, it's the intent. It feels like someone living here is just to sow terror. But at the same time, I think also looking at the way that the city, the residents here have responded, I think that's a really important part of it as well, because people are not just taking it and accepting that our neighbors and our friends are being literally ripped from their families and their homes.
I want to play for our audience some of the video that you gathered last week. This was a week after Renee Good's killing in the incident that you briefly described.
They're taking them! They're taking people now! They're taking people! They're pulling people out of their cars!
Those are excerpts of a video that my guest Maria Burns Ortiz captured just last week on the streets of Minneapolis. For our radio audience, Maria, we heard the sirens. We heard, I think there was an activist saying, "Where's your humanity?" And it might have been your voice saying they're pulling people out of their cars. But essentially, there were a small army of ICE agents, all to subdue one woman.
Well, that's not even why they were there, we learned. I mean, we were driving home from dropping our children at school. We were driving and suddenly traffic stopped. And everyone, as you do in a major city street, when suddenly traffic stops and there's no clear reason, looked around. We looked at the people, the cars next to us, saw the woman even in the car next to us, not understanding what would then unfold. And suddenly we kind of look up and there's a group of armed, masked men, right, in the street, blocking traffic, and a woman comes running around down the street, blowing a whistle, which we know means that there's ICE activity, and telling people to start honking your horns. Everyone starts honking your horns because we, as a city, I think, you know, are not in favor of the brutality that's going on. And they surround the car that's next to us, and within a matter of minutes have ripped a woman from the car for what we can tell is no reason, as far as we can understand. And then reading later the statements about why that happened, it just wasn't supported by the video in any way, shape, or form, or anything that any of us witnessed. It was it's unbelievable. It's very surreal that this is happening in the United States of America at this moment.
Now, the whistle that you mentioned, that has been something that I believe really gained steam in Chicago first and has spread to many cities. Explain how people are using whistles to alert each other of danger.
Yes. So, and throughout the city, for example, at schools as well, every morning when you drop children off at schools, our schools are surrounded by community members who have whistles, who are there to, keep the honestly community members who are here to keep children within our community safe, right? These whistles that if ice it comes into the area, they start blowing whistles to alert everyone what's going on, because we, you know, have seen the brutality that happens and the things that are trying to get done, that they're trying to do in our communities. And so the whistles, when you hear the whistles, that means that ICE is in the area, that they are, you know, possibly engaging in activity. And we want to make sure that if, people have been saying, oh, those are paid agitators, they're protesters. We were just two, in our case, we were just two people driving home from dropping our children off at school, my husband and I, right? And so, but yes, the whistles are they let people know that ICE is in the area and to alert them. So that people can be prepared, because as you can see, situations are very, very ugly and as far as what's happening here.
We are now hearing reports that there are 1,500 military forces on standby, potentially ready to enter Minneapolis. I mean, this is not even a city with a very high percentage of undocumented immigrants, even if you take the idea of why ICE should be present at face value, which of course everybody knows that's not true. But a city like Minneapolis, you know, people have tried to make sense of it. Is it because Governor Tim Walz, challenged Donald Trump as vice presidential candidate for Kamala Harris in the last election? Is it because this is a city that has been grappling with what happened in 2020? And had some minor progress around police accountability 6 years ago? You know, why Minneapolis? People are really like trying to imagine, and now to potentially throw 1,500 armed military members into this, people who are trained to fight wars. If that were to pass, what do you suppose might happen?
You know, it feels very dystopian, to be quite honest. What I think, you know, if it happens, if they send me, I don't know if the idea is if they think that everyone will just go away. I mean, we are, and I say this, for, you know, we live in a place where it is really, really cold, right? This morning, the wind chill is something like negative 23, right? We are a very resilient, resolute people. In Minnesota, I mean, you need it to get through long, dark winters here. And it's very frightening at the same time to think that our government, that our elected leaders would be looking to turn our military on us for simply being out there and exercising First Amendment rights, for simply being, you know, against and speaking out vocally against the treatment that is happening. I think it's really hard to even process, even though we hear these stories and every day it's just more unbelievable. But yeah, like I said, the only word really for it feels very dystopian, somewhere between dystopian and surreal, because you cannot believe that this is where we are. But every day, again, there's ICE agents patrolling the streets. You know, we live, Minneapolis has a police force of 600 officers. And the reports that we've been hearing are there are 3,000 ICE agents. So there are 5 ICE agents for every police officer in the city of Minneapolis right now. That doesn't make sense to any of us. The crime levels, you know, this is not to say that there's never any crime ever in the city of Minneapolis, but there's nothing that could potentially justify or warrant what is going on here.
How are members of the immigrant community dealing with this. And I don't just mean people who might be undocumented. I mean legal residents. I mean people who've naturalized, people from mixed status families, people like yourself who might be mistaken for being, or, you know, just basically a non-white person. what is the fear like right now?
It is, and this is one of the things where I feel very obligated to be out living my life as a U.S. citizen, because they're trying, there are so many people, and I've had conversations with immigrant friends of mine who are saying, you know, it's important that that continue to happen, because the fear is so overwhelming for so many families. I mean, schools are seeing, you know, the public schools have gone to distance learning because families don't feel safe sending their children to schools. My son is, I have a fifth grade son, and the other night it was about 10:45, and he was talking to a friend, and I said, why are you, it's late, you need to get up. And his friend had called me, his friend's parents are immigrants, and said, his friend had called him and said his mom went to the supermarket and he was afraid she was never coming home. Oh. And you have a fifth grader talking down another fifth grader, telling him it'll be okay, you can't be thinking that way. Every day we're hearing story. We have a large immigrant community, a network around our family. We're hearing stories every day of someone being taken, grabbed off the street, including people who are here with work authorization. So parents, you know, from whether it's back to school night, you know, your kids, friends, parents, the parents at the soccer games next to you, a high school student, a daughter's friend of mine was over in her from the high school where her parent works, a student was taken. So not from the school, but, you know, picked up by ICE, a high school senior. So the stories are, it's, you know, there's very narratives about, oh, they're all criminals and all of these things. That's not what they're doing. They're picking up moms at bus stops, you know, moms and dads. They're taking kids that are potentially the kid in your next to your child in math class. You know, so there's just no explanation for it. And the fear is really, really palpable. And I mean, you have families going into hiding, like leaving their house in the middle of the night under cover of darkness to go to a different location where people are saying, yes, you can stay at my house. That is happening in, like I keep saying, in Minneapolis, in the United States of America. We are seeing that happen right now.
What about attacks on journalists? You're a former journalist. I can see that your instincts kicked into gear when you started recording, and you've been posting to your social media about what's been happening. We just heard CNN's Don Lemon is being investigated by the federal government just for being at covering an ICE protest. I imagine it's also a terribly tough time to be a journalist at the moment when it's more necessary than ever.
And we're seeing that lesson. We were at, when we were, and again, it's hard, we weren't at a protest, you know, on Tuesday. We were driving home and this scene unfolded. So, but, you know, the media were there. We were actually, where this happened was the next main street over from where Renee Good was shot the week over. So it was the week before it was two blocks. But, and so there's people in the area. I know there were other journalists, actually working journalists there, who also got hit by tear gas, because at the end, it seemed like the scene was dispersing. People were heading back to their cars, and suddenly, you know, they'd been doing, I don't know, words like pepper spray, like almost little kind of paintball type of things initially around that. But as people were kind of heading back to their cars, suddenly, within a two block radius, it was just overwhelming. I know the number that media were there and also got hit by that just for being in that area, including a number of citizens. We're talking a very residential area that was happening. I know there's the image that, if folks haven't seen it, a Getty Images reporter was, you know, grabbed by ICE covering one of the protests. I believe it was by the federal building here. And in it, he is throwing his camera to a colleague so that they do not get the images and can take them, because we're seeing the stories that are coming directly conflict all of the evidence that is being collected by those who are there recording it and capturing these scenes. It's very difficult. Someone has said previously, I was in a journalist, 10 some years ago, but to see colleagues or former colleagues, friends, people coming to the city of Minneapolis and bringing the same gear that they bring to go cover war. It's really hard to find the words for it because it's happening in your own neighborhood and you can't imagine that that's where we have come to, but it's where we are.
Right. And that kind of documentation also matters for like legal challenges that people are hopefully going to, be able to pursue. I know lawyers on the ground as well that are doing as much rapid work as they possibly can, given that ICE is just whisking people into their, zip ties and then disappearing them, flying them to Texas within hours to El Paso. It's really quite surreal and really quite terrifying. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Maria. I really appreciate your time.
No worries. Thank you so much.
My guest has been Maria Burns Ortiz, a nonprofit executive director, game studio founder, and former journalist. She lives in Minneapolis with her husband and three children. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Nearly 6 years ago, the people of Minneapolis took center stage in unprecedented protests against racial police terror after George Floyd was videotaped being murdered. Now, the Twin Cities area is once more ground zero for similar kind of organized racial terror at the hands of armed agents of the state, as ICE agents have run rampant across Minneapolis and St. Paul, killing, maiming, and violating. How have locals responded and fought back? My guest is Shannon Gibney. She's a member of Minneapolis Families for Public Schools. She's also a professor of English at Minneapolis College, where for over 15 years she's worked with refugees and ex-offenders, international and in-country immigrants, indigenous and communities of color, and students from all walks of life to tell their stories. Her most recent book is We Miss You, George Floyd. Welcome to the program, Shannon.
Thanks for having me.
So first, the way in which Minnesotans, people in Minneapolis and St. Paul have been responding has certainly made the news for those of us outside. But give us a sense of the tone of the resistance on the ground. I understand that you wrote a story for the Minnesota Star Tribune called Minnesotans Seem to Be Done Playing Minnesota Nice. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I moved here as a transplant more than 22 years ago, my late 20s, after graduate school, because the state has a wonderful artist community and infrastructure for artists. And it's been great for me and my family overall to be here. But, I'm a Midwesterner. I was born and raised in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But coming here, you find this thing called Minnesota Nice, which is basically like, oh, we're, nice in quotes to everyone, but at least on the surface. But for communities of color and folks from historically marginalized communities, we have a very different experience historically with Minnesota Nice. It sort of has been this way to other people who don't sort of fit into this kind of old school white Minnesotan rural idea of what it means to be a Minnesotan. But since, you know, I argue in that piece that you mentioned that appeared this weekend in the Star Tribune, you know, I argue that since George Floyd and the subsequent uprisings, and then now going through the siege of the federal agent siege of ICE agents, but also Customs and Border Control folks, we're developing a new state ethos. and it's less around Minnesota Nice. And, you know, somebody outside the region told me it's like Minnesota Good. You know, and it's not, I wouldn't say it's new. You know, this state has always had a tradition of, you know, working class roots and, you know, supporting folks, the least among us, right? The most vulnerable. So that's a huge, I think, strain of the resistance culture going on right now in this crisis. It's definitely activating those strands. But yeah, some of the other strands around Minnesota Nice, which, you know, those of us who are, you know, particularly people of color, Black and people of color, like we welcome that particular change. If we don't welcome the agents on the ground here terrorizing our communities. Right.
Now, we've seen over the past year, cities like Los Angeles become flashpoints, New York City. Minneapolis doesn't seem to be a likely place where the worst of the ICE terror would play out. So it might be surprising for those of us on the outside. And yet Minneapolis, as I mentioned in my introduction, became the flashpoint, the ground zero for anti-police protests after the murder of George Floyd. Put that into a national context for us. And also how, if you can explain how the events of nearly 6 years ago, of the summer of 2020, prepared folks for what they're experiencing today.
As I'm sure many of your viewers and listeners know, Minneapolis and Minnesota didn't ask for this ICE surge. We didn't want it. You know, looking at the amount of undocumented immigrants that we actually have in the state, we have not very many at all compared to states like Texas and Florida and, you know, some other red states, which are not getting, you know, 3,000 ICE agents, and now the threat of, you know, 1,500 more paratroopers from Alaska and like whatever else, right? This administration, which is, you know, vindictive and, you know, all about retribution, feels like they need to send in here. And so we really feel like, you know, at the height of the Chicago siege, there was maybe like 600 agents, right? And we're a third of the size of Chicago, just to give you some sense of the scale of this operation. And so there's kind of no way that you can't feel the effects of this living in Minneapolis and then increasingly, you know, into the suburbs and out to the exurbs and in rural areas as well. The other week, I woke up at 6:40 in the morning to two agents laughing outside my front door and detaining two of my neighbors. I couldn't see who they were. We're still trying to track them down, me and my neighborhood group. I ran down the stairs as fast as I could because I know how fast they move. It's like under 30 seconds a lot of times. They get people cuffed and whisked away into their cars. And so I was in my pajamas. I ran down the stairs. I didn't bother to put on my jacket, even though it's so cold here right now, and just got on my slippers, ran out and recorded any information I could, and then uploaded it to the Southside Rapid Response Group. And they were able to give me some intel on the fact that, yep, these folks have been in your neighborhood since 6 a.m. terrorizing terrorizing folks.
And we're learning that people are being detained and then instantly sent to Fort Bliss in El Paso, like within 12 hours, disappeared, yeah, like very far from the state. And yeah, already there were reports that at least one person who was taken from Minnesota has died in, yeah, ICE custody in El Paso. It's quite, yeah, remarkable the speed at which they're operating.
Yeah, it's, and you know, there was a family that was abducted in my neighborhood last week, and you know, because of the rapid response networks, that some of which were created, you know, you asked a question about, you know, 5 years ago and George Floyd and the uprisings. You know, there were already a lot of these informal neighborhood networks and community networks of resistance sort of already in place. We had white supremacists invade our neighborhood that summer as well. And so we had to get a lot of these rapid response networks in place. We're not all, it's not like we just sort of like started using the same ones, but I think people were like familiar with that mode of resistance. And just the fact that, like, you know, this idea that it's like, okay, the federal government is in this particular moment now, like they are the aggressor. So they're not coming to protect us, right? And then our state and local government folks, they're doing what they can, but they can't do very much. And then when they do something, like Mayor Jacob Frey and Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota, like they now are being investigated by the DOJ, right? So it just this feeling of like, well, we have to protect ourselves. We have to protect the people in our communities that can't protect themselves in this moment. And that's really what people are doing.
And also just to piggyback on what you were saying about officials being investigated after the murder of Renee Good, now federal investigators have completely ignored the person who killed her and are instead investigating Renee Good's wife.
Which is, I can't even imagine the nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's making people here irate. Like, we just. And so I will say, in, you know, 22 years living here as a Black woman, this is the first time I felt super proud to be a Minnesotan. Mm. Like, just the way, like, everybody understands that this is an all hands on deck situation and that everybody can do something. So people are signing up for rapid response patrols in their neighborhoods and around their schools. They are, you know, we set up like, I'm working with my son's high school in South Minneapolis, and we set up various mutual aid funds. So we have paired now 200 ally families with 200 buddy families in this hyperlocal, right? So, I mean, my buddy family is about a block away from me. And we deliver food to them if they need like diapers or, you know, other personal items. We'll do that as well every week. And then we're also, another part of the mutual aid is getting funds for rent support, because a lot of these folks that are most impacted can't work. They can't even leave their homes. You know, they haven't left their apartment since December. And many of the ones most in need have had somebody kidnapped, and that person was the breadwinner. And so they're not able to make rent. And so we have to date raised, I think, about $125,000 through giving on our GoFundMe. And then we've distributed about $92,000 of that. Most of it for rent support, and the need just keeps increasing. And so there's something for everyone to do. You know, there's people who are retired and they're on a fixed income, so they can't give to the GoFundMe, and that's fine. But guess what? They have time to do patrols. And then there are people who are like, you know, I work a lot, and so I can't be out in the streets. And so those people can give money, and so on and so forth. So, but people understand, like, we are drawing the line. We are drawing the line against we're not going to allow people to weaponize food in our and starve our neighbors. We're not going to allow people to cut certain children off from school and all of the learning and the socialization and the food even that comes from that experience. We're not going to let folks just willy-nilly drive up and steal somebody who lives two doors down from me, and then is like disappeared. We're not going to allow these things. It doesn't matter what the federal government does.
Shannon, I'm wondering if you can go a little bit deeper in your analysis around how people are or aren't making the connections between armed agents of the state and their well-being. For so long, Black folks, people of color, not just in Minneapolis, but all over the country, have been saying that police are the problem. And it's not about giving them body cameras or better training. And 2020 was a breaking point, and then a lot of backtracking after that. And now we're seeing ICE agents in cities around the country, including in Minneapolis. And I'm hearing some folks say things like, police should arrest the ICE agents who are terrorizing us, as if these are separate forces. I mean, maybe technically they're not exactly part of the, you know, the same force. But how do you draw that line? How do you make those connections in a way that becomes obvious to people? Black folks have been on the receiving end of police terror. Latino folks and people who are suspected of being immigrants are on the receiving end of ICE terror. And now white people
here,
who are standing up to them, are on the receiving end.
Yeah, yes. Honestly, Sonali, that those connections are really hard for people from the dominant classes to make. I mean, most of the people, honestly, that I hear saying things like, well, we need the National Guard to come in and, you know, like defend us. And we need, what is it? The Minneapolis Police Department needs to, and it's like, I don't hear any Black people disproportionately borne the brunt of, you know, like Minneapolis Police Department violence and along with Native folks here in the Twin Cities, because we do have a large Native population as well. Like, I don't hear those folks saying those things. I mean, during George Floyd, the governor did mobilize the National Guard, and they came in and they were marching through our neighborhoods with guns and like sometimes tanks, and like just they made us less safe. They weren't helping, you know, they were making things worse. And so I think trying to make those connections between people, you know, for people that also in terms of like the way the DOJ is turning people into criminals, right? Or enemies of the state, you know, just for standing up for the people in their communities, right? Like to kind of get people to make those connections of like, no, this is all part, like, as you said, like this might be like a different arm of this carceral system, but like it's really actually coming from the same place. And the way that it's operating is also coming from the same place. This is just an extreme example.
And then finally, Shannon, the federal view of what's happening includes a huge boost to the ICE funding this last year. And now when there is an appropriations bill that's coming up that includes more funding for ICE, you would have thought that the opposition party would be lining up against cutting funds to ICE and responding to the broad support from around the country that is saying abolish ICE, right? Echoing those calls to defund the police. And Democrats, many of them are like people like Chuck Schumer and Cory Booker, are refusing. They still continue to feel that ICE as an agency is legitimate, even with Trump in power. I mean, that seems quite tone deaf. And I'm wondering if you can explain what sort of agitation there is coming from Minneapolis against Democrats, or any pushback, or are just people too overwhelmed and are, you know, dealing with the short-term danger and relying on the rest of the country to echo their calls to abolish ICE?
Well, you know, in December, when ICE really descended in mass here, activists and organizers in Chicago were incredibly generous, and they shared their, you know, ICE Watch trainings with us and have been throughout all of this, which was incredibly helpful. But one thing they said to us from the beginning, which was very instructive and helpful, was like, no one is coming to save us.
Mm.
No one is coming to save us. The federal government, they're certainly not coming to save us. They are the aggressor. right? The local government's hands are tied. Like, we have to be the ones to save ourselves and save our most vulnerable, right? And so this is the kind of like the roadmap, you know, that we created in Chicago to do that. And y'all can, you know, obviously you're going to kind of move it and develop it in ways that work for Minneapolis and Minnesota. And so, I mean, I am not surprised personally that the Democratic Party nationally is so anemic and out of touch with both their base nationally and also, you know, what's going on, like the terror and the violence and the human rights abuses, frankly, that are going on the ground here in Minnesota. I'm not surprised at all. For a while now, I've felt like it's really like my community and to a lesser extent, like my local government that I have faith in. I don't have any faith that like nationally the Democratic Party is going to save us. And you know, the reason for that, as a lot of other people have pointed out, is because they're just in bed. They're just as much in bed with these corporations that are benefiting from this as the Republicans, you know, like Enterprise Car Rental, I guess, like all these.
And Target. There's a big action around Target happening in Minneapolis where people are occupying the stores to demand that Target stop letting ICE use their property to stage operations. And of course, Target was one of the first companies to roll over when Trump pulled back the DEI initiatives in January of 2025, a year ago, and has Target has faced this quite successful boycott over the past year. It seems to not be learning its lesson. Well, no. Shannon, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I want to wish you good luck. Stay safe out there. We are certainly watching you from here in LA and sending you solidarity.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My guest has been Shannon Gibney. She's a member of Minneapolis Families for Public Schools, also a professor of English at Minneapolis College. And we've been talking about, and her most recent book is We Miss You, George Floyd. We've been talking about how Minnesotans are done playing nice with ICE. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. The Trump administration and Republican Party's push to enrich already wealthy people at the expense of the rest of us is resulting in one of the largest upward wealth transfers in the history of the nation. The so-called Big Beautiful Bill rewards the wealthiest Americans with $2.3 trillion in tax cuts. To counter that, activists in states around the country are calling on governors to enact state-level taxation of the rich. Already, the state of Massachusetts has been levying taxes on millionaires for a couple of years. But California, home to a disproportionate number of billionaires, is dealing with a governor who's eyeing the presidency and resolutely opposing the tax. This in spite of strong public appetite for taxing the rich. My guest is Liz Perlman, executive director of AFSCME 3299, representing more than 40,000 service and patient care technical workers at the University of California. She also serves on the University of California Berkeley Labor Center Advisory Board and the Bargaining for Common Good Advisory Board. Welcome to the program, Liz.
Thank you for having me.
So let's first talk about the severity of the problem. You know, the Trump administration floated into its second term by claiming that it was going to be a populist presidency. Trump essentially convinced, you know, just enough people in just enough states that he cared about the common man. And of course, most of us had been paying close attention, understood it was exactly the opposite. And this transfer of wealth that he has helped to enact, that he has backed, how severely will it impact people around the country if states don't act? What are we looking at? What are the things that we're going to lose?
Well, you know, I think that folks are already feeling it, right? I mean, they've been feeling it and they haven't felt relief on just a day-to-day level, cost of living, gas, groceries, whatnot, the cost of housing. And I think with healthcare, you know, many people have already seen their premiums skyrocket because of the gap in the tax credits for the ACA. And so, but what the states are facing with the so-called Big Beautiful Bill is that, you know, specifically California, and then you can apply it to, you know, many other states, we're facing a $30 billion cliff in 2027 from some estimates. And, you know, that is amounts to 20% of the essentially the healthcare infrastructure going away, meaning people will lose coverage. And those dollars, right, when you lose people who are on healthcare, and those dollars are gone from the healthcare networks and the healthcare system, which are all one system. You know, there's not a, you know, people don't go to separate hospitals. There's your area hospital, and that's where you're going to go. And so if 20% of the patients in that area lose their healthcare, there are going to be cuts. That is just the only way, you know, these healthcare systems are not in hospitals, especially rural hospitals, can't grow money on trees. And so if they lose those, and we're already seeing those effects everywhere. And then I would say, in addition, you know, there's already cuts to the SNAP and food benefits for folks. You know, those are direct. Folks are going to be struggling without, you know, just without the basic necessities with food. And we saw this crisis over the holidays with food banks, you know, and then it's again kind of relying on the like philanthropy of, you know, some good people. But that's just frankly, like, not a way to run a society in which people need to eat. You know, I mean, we're just the wealthiest country in the world. And, you know, we can solve this problem. And it is a shame that the federal government is failing its people. You know, we can comment on why and all that. But at the end of the day, it is a failure. And, you know, governors of states across the country shouldn't have to figure this out, right? This is a national problem, but we're here. And without it, the people who are living in some of the most populated states are going to see some of the biggest cuts. And it's just, these are kind of untenable, right? Like I've been telling folks, you know, on one side is taxing the wealthy, on the other side is people dying. So I know which side I'm on. You know, there's really no other choice.
So let's talk about what it is that union members, activists, labor activists are calling on states to do. Of course, you know, for anybody who's filed taxes, and within a couple of months, we're going to be deep in tax season, we file federal taxes, we file state taxes, depending on where you live. And those usually fund different kinds of things. States are often able to provide or fill holes that are gaps that the federal government can't fill. It seems as though, as you mentioned just now, states are going to be called upon to really look out for people in the absence of federal help. Where are things going well? I mentioned Massachusetts. Tell me about Massachusetts and any other states where state governments are actually helping to address the shortfall.
Yeah, so historically, Massachusetts, California, New York, you know, to a certain extent, where there are, you know, essentially like high, ultra wealthy or high wage earners, there are, you know, states that do income taxes on those, including California. And so, you know, Massachusetts was an incredible success story, right, where they're bringing in billions of dollars for education. But I think that right, that the challenge has been, since a lot of these taxes have been passed, is that two things have happened. One is that they were, you know, taxing the ultra wealthy policies that were passed, you know, in a few years ago for Massachusetts, or even a decade ago in California, solved for a decade old problem, right? And we are now facing essentially a healthcare cliff, right?
Let's talk about the main issue that is often raised when it comes to taxing the wealthy. They're going to leave, right? Oh, they're going to leave. They'll leave New York City if the new mayor there enacts a tax. They're going to leave Massachusetts. They're going to leave the state of Washington or the city of Seattle. And of course, that is precisely the logic that California Governor Gavin Newsom is holding on tightly to in his very vehement opposition to a proposed billionaire tax. Let's talk about that. Massachusetts shows no one's leaving because they're flush with so much cash that they actually, it probably wouldn't be worth it for wealthy people to leave if they're taxed a little bit. So why can't that be a good enough model? Why can't Massachusetts and the fact that millionaires haven't left from being taxed be a good enough model for Newsom? What is his game?
Well, I can't speak for Newsom or what his game is, but what I do know is that the argument around billionaires moving is absolutely a red herring. And it's very intentional because at the bottom, at the base of it is that the wealthy don't want to pay. That's it. There's many of them that they just don't want to hand it up. They just don't want to pay. And so right now, while there is an active question and that question hasn't been settled, it is, I believe it's being used as a threat. Now that some billionaires may move or have moved, I think that I feel strongly, and I kind of, you know, I wish that Gavin Newsom and other governors would be more confident about their own state, frankly, because California is awesome. Like I moved here when I was 17 and it's great. Like it's beautiful. There's beaches, there's mountains. Like you kind of want to have your kids grow up here. And the only people who have to leave are the people who can't afford it because the cost of living is 40% higher than any other state. And so that's who is genuinely leaving.
Right. No one worries about poor people being forced to leave, or people being forced to leave because they can't afford housing.
Exactly. Right?
But and somehow we all have to freak out about billionaires leaving.
Yeah, right. And it's being talked about in the context of a campaign to stop people from supporting it, right? That is what, so, you know, it is, I think that's really challenging because study, you know, and I think that many organizations, I think it's the Fair Tax Policy Center, they've seen these trends don't bear out, right? I mean, if a billionaire is now currently purchasing his 17th home in Florida as essentially a like boogeyman to say to voters in California, I'm going to move to Florida. It's like, yeah, okay, but I feel like it also shifts the conversation away from the actual harm that's happening.
Now, the tax initiative in California, I understand, is a ballot measure, or would be a ballot measure, and if it were to pass, Newsom wouldn't be able to veto it. He can only veto if it goes through the legislative process. And it just seems so strange that somebody who claims that they are against Trump, who is trolling Trump and reducing the election, you know, that's coming in 2028 to this like popularity contest about who can be better on social media, is instead of actually focusing on policy, you know, and opposing Trump's tax cut by taxing billionaires more in California, is coming out swinging against it. And he's claiming, he's couching it. His logic is, I'm going to do what I have to do to protect the state. So opposing a billionaire tax is equivalent to protecting the state. But of course, it's just protecting billionaires. And I'm wondering how critical it is for people to push back against this logic and to really push for California to start taxing billionaires in a way that makes our society actually work?
Well, I think it's what we're seeing across the country, which is that people are getting organized and making up their own minds and not necessarily only following the direction of a few key leaders or billionaires who are, you know, funding a PR campaign against a proposition that would tax them, right? So, and I think that people, you know, you see why it's so popular that people are like, yeah, the wealthy should pay. And I, again, I can't speak for Gavin Newsom or any other governor who is opposed to this. And I think that the fundamental question is people want leaders to actually solve problems. And unfortunately, right now, all we're hearing is we have to protect billionaires because a few of them are threatening to leave the state, or, you know, in other cases, you know, people make all kinds of arguments, but we're not hearing an alternative solution. All we're hearing is Trump is bad. It's terrible what he's done. And exactly. So then
it's like vote for
president.
Me. I'm not Trump, basically. Yeah, is yeah. And that's
versus
what why Kamala
solution.
Harris failed. That's why Hillary Clinton failed. I mean, we just, yeah.
Yeah, there's a, I think there's also an interesting question for anybody who's in elected office, but also just the, everyone living in this country is like, we have to be talking about alternate solutions. And I think that's why I'm so impressed and just like absolutely proud to support the efforts of, you know, the hospital workers union, SEIU-UHW, that's saying, you know what, no one is coming up with anything else. So we're going to do something, you know? And unfortunately, I'm not hearing kind of like, okay, well, I have a problem with this particular tax issue, you know, or some way it's written or whatever, you know, whatever the kind of particulars. But you know what, here's a better way to do it. And this way we'll capture the money and, you know, we'll make sure that the wealthy pay. Like, we're not hearing that. All we're hearing is the rhetoric and the talking points. And that is, you know, we can't feed our kids on talking points. We can't, right. You know, take them to the doctor on rhetoric. Like, we need real solutions. And so working people right now are taking matters into their own hands. And, you know, absolutely, voters will decide. And I'm sure there would be a blitzkrieg of a campaign because billionaires have unlimited money to spend to try to confuse people and scare people. And that's what they're doing now. But I think it still comes down to, okay, but what is the plan then that is more than simply blaming Trump? And I think we owe it to our families, to our communities as working people. I represent 40,000 people who work two or three jobs every day. Like, you know, we owe it to each other to push and not be afraid of kind of, you know, I guess the political class that says, no, you're not supposed to ask for that. It's like, well, right. what else are we supposed to do? Where the alternative is our members are dying of preventable diseases because they can't get in to see the doctor. That's the alternative. And it's like, that's just unacceptable. It is unacceptable, yeah. The alternative. And so, you know, it's there's no easy path here, but I think working people are standing up, and I think it's really beautiful. It's just, you know, no one knows the future, so we'll see what happens.
I want to thank you so much for joining us, Liz, and we'll see what happens in California. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
My guest has been Liz Perlman, Executive Director of AFSCME 3299, representing more than 40,000 service and patient care technical workers at the University of California. And we've been talking about state-level efforts to tax the rich. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.